Today, I'm joined by Flora Meston. She is a writer, a researcher at Orthodox Conservatives, and a political commentator. Welcome, Flora.
Thank you.
It's lovely to have you on. I mean, you're kind of, I would say, a rising star, someone that people keep telling me would be a good fit for the podcast. You're someone from a slightly different generation than I am, and I think that's why I thought it would be really interesting to have you on as a young woman, as a social conservative, and someone who might be, you know, giving us a glimpse into how what the temperature is like in a slightly different generation. Because I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast are probably more of my generation, like mid-30s, and they're looking at the world, you know, through their own lenses. They have their own interpretation, but I wonder what it's like to be a young woman, to look out at the world and decide, okay, I'm a social conservative. I mean, how have you reached this point? Why, you know, where does this revelation come from?
So I don't have much of an exciting sort of origin story of how I became a conservative, because my parents met through the Conservative Party. So dinner table conversations were always very political, well, not very political, but sort of discussing current affairs. I definitely absorbed my parents' views on things, was raised going to church. And my dad studied theology, so it was always, you know, great to have him for any religious questions I had. He was like, knew everything, it seemed. I was raised sort of talking about politics, but I got interested during Brexit because one of my close friends at school, her uncle is Dominic Cummings. So she really was convincing us hard that Brexit was the right way to go. And suddenly it felt like something to be excited about, and sort of I was seeing it happening in real time, like this big event. I joined the Conservative Party as a teenager, and did things like I was like the treasurer of my local Young Conservatives and stood for local election. But during COVID, well, sort of after lockdowns ended, I just looked at the party and thought, you don't stand for anything that I believe in, because I have conservative values, but you don't. And you don't even have sort of freedom values. I left because they were going to introduce vaccine passports for nightclubs. And I thought, I can't align myself with someone who's this authoritarian and not even conservative with it. So mm-hmm. I just sort of ended up looking at fringe groups and, you know, finding people that thought like me online. That's the great thing about the online world, is you can just find people that agree with you so easily and be like, oh, I'm not alone. There's so many people who think like me. And it feels like quite an exciting time, because especially with the world of Twitter, and people can so easily connect and they've got really great, exciting ideas about how we can improve the UK, especially because it's quite a depressing place to be as a young woman in her 20s who wants to have a family and sees sort of no future here. So yeah, I think that's sort of my story.
Yeah, I mean, that's, there's kind of two cohorts that come on this podcast, like people who are disillusioned liberals, or people, liberals mugged by reality, or people who are probably more in the minority, people who've been conservative and have not felt a need to rebel from their home environment. But I think this is, you know, you're purebred, and we appreciate that on this podcast, you know, a rarity, a purebred conservative woman. I think this is a interesting origin story, especially in the context of the UK, because the UK, I feel like it's kind of the Conservative Party in the UK is past its prime in a way that is rare in the world, especially because the UK also is a big producer of media. Like, at least I'm more connected to the UK than other countries in Europe, and it's only second to the US in terms of how much people know about the politics in there. And it really feels like the Conservative Party in the UK is going belly up in a dramatic fashion. And I feel like, you know, what you've been saying, that the fringe groups are more exciting in the UK, and it feels like the fringe groups are slowly starting to eat up just the energy that was still left in the party. So how do you see this transition? You see that there is a potential transition? Are any of the fringe groups promising in an effective political way? Are people organizing, or is it still at the, you know, at the podcast stage? Are people still kind of discussing this, or is actual policy work happening?
I don't think they're really going to do anything or gain any power as the groups that they are. I think what they're very useful for is, you know, hosting conferences or getting people together and sharing ideas and convincing people of great policy ideas. But obviously we're basically a two-party system, and I just think it's tough to say. Lots of people say reform is the way to go, or we need conservatives out. I think conservatives need some time out, but I think the people from these fringe groups need to just get in there and take over and just make it conservative again, because they've got so much potential. I mean, what the majority they won in 2019 was like, this is handed to you on a plate. You can make the country amazing, and they've just like pissed it up the wall, if I can say that.
You can, no worries. I mean, that's been the problem, because it's quite easy for the conservatives to gain power. I mean, they've been in power for quite a long time, but they've been abusing their mandate. And I mean, in terms of, you know, the groups that you're in, I mean, I guess you being conservative, you know, the people around you are conservative. With young women, I mean, I wonder, like, what is the temperature? Do your friends share your, you know, disgust at the situation, or is it a bit of a mixed bag? I mean, what's going on?
I have, I'd say, fewer than 10 friends who are firmly on the right. So many of my female friends just aren't interested in politics, or they are centrist or centre left, but don't engage. I think a huge thing that my female friends are concerned about is trans stuff. I've got a lot of turfy friends, because that's sort of a threat to womanhood, and you want to feel safe, and having men being able to access toilets, changing rooms, that's a huge issue. I don't find that I have many female friends who share my biggest concern, which is sort of mass immigration in the UK. I think that's mainly my male friends, and I've sort of leaned into that with them, and trying to convince my female friends that this is affecting so many things, that like goals that we have in life, like being able to afford a house, have children, who can get GP appointments, places in schools, when we're having hundreds of thousands of people come into the country every year, which is using resources and housing and everything. Like, that's with my main life goal being, I want to be a mum, I want to have a family. And I would love, I know it seems really impossible, to be able to do that on one income so that I could stay at home with children. But with and I think so many of the effects of mass immigration are blocking that goal for me and other young women.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, it's one of those concerns that just feels icky to talk about as a young woman, I think. I remember, you know, I'm pretty disagreeable myself, and I tended to bring that up, especially when I was with, you know, colleagues in the UK and things like that. Obviously, in a very like mild way, like, you know, if you think Somalia has the right of self-determination, why shouldn't, you know, the British people have it as well, and things like that. And they would just completely change color because they knew I was getting close to the third rail, and I would have maybe a little bit more leeway because I was, one, an immigrant, and two, a woman. So, you know, things wouldn't shut down instantly, but still, it seemed to be just very low status to be thinking about that. It was, you know, it reeked of Tommy Robinson and, you know, all of this stuff. And it wasn't, in tech, finance, people wouldn't talk about this stuff, maybe to their best friends or after many, many drinks, but not, you know, with the, I don't know, other employees at the Christmas party. Maybe that's just a cue for me that, you know, you don't talk religion and politics at parties. But anyway, I had to, because I felt like, okay, this was this looming crisis around everyone and no one wanted to touch it. And it just felt so obvious that this was, you know, not only urgent, but it was something that a lot of people were thinking of in the background. And it was just not mentioned, so unmentionable. So yeah, and I think women are much more attuned to this, you know, to the, you know, non-autistic side of life. You know, you need to be sensitive to people. And the fact that these groups are already kind of mixed, so, you know, you don't want to offend anyone there as well. So it just kind of remains on the back burner, and it has to be moved to the front burner because, you know, life in general, politics, the course of history will move it to the front. Anyway, it's not, you can't avoid this stuff. So yeah, it's unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, I think there's certain arguments that are sort of more compassionate, more, I don't know, people might think are more appropriate for a woman to make. One of them being like, stop the boats, because people are dying on these horrible boat journeys and they're being scammed by people traffickers, and it's awful and it shouldn't be happening. But it's almost like it's wrong for us to talk about how change of culture is also an issue, or grooming gangs from Pakistani groups of men. But these are also things that really do affect women, and we shouldn't be afraid to talk about. And I think that I sort of made a decision a while ago that I am a face poster on X, and I need to be brave and stand by my opinions, because then other people will find them acceptable. Because it should be fine to say these things. It shouldn't be controversial. I'm just saying truth and facts, and I want like more young women. I know most of my followers are young men, but like, to be able to join in and say like, yeah, we're not afraid to say this anymore, because it's an immediate threat and something's got to change really quickly, or I don't know what's going to happen. I don't want to know what's going to happen to this country.
I think you mentioned this before, but I think turfism is a really good gateway drug for a lot of right-wing ideas. I mean, it's, some people might stay at just being TERFs, but the fact that, you know, this stuff is starting to encroach on your literal spaces, like there are people, you know, waving their genitals around at the gym. This is already a very, very real, very intimate intrusion of progressive politics into people's lives. So I think it's I'm in a way kind of grateful for how fast trans stuff has escalated, because it might give a chance to other aspects of more kind of socially conservative politics to penetrate the mainstream.
Yeah, definitely. I know quite a few people who started off as just feminists that became TERFs that have now entered the right-wing sphere. Like one of my great friends, she came to NatCon just because she was a TERF. And I met her there, and now she's sort of been to so many more things. She's got so many more ideas, and she's firmly on our side now, and it's just great. But yeah, there's other things which can be great gateway drugs. Like, so a couple of years ago, I live in Bristol, and I saw an advertisement for a family sex show at a local theatre, and I thought, what is that family sex show? So I clicked on it, and it was aimed at age 5+ to teach children about sex, but it included songs about finding the clitoris. The website included things like how to masturbate, and told children to Google which animals masturbate and how. And the show itself involved the whole cast, which included obviously some non-binaries and whatevers, getting completely naked on stage and also pretending to have sex on stage. And so I tweeted about this, and it started this whole campaign. Eventually it got cancelled, and they had their Arts Council funding withdrawn. Poor guys. But
good work.
Yeah. Yeah, I was very proud of that. But Mumsnet just took off. There were so many threads where people would suddenly, as soon as their kids are threatened, or obviously this isn't just going to be a theatre show, they're going to take school trips there, they're going to go into schools, it's just a slippery slope. So parents, mums mainly, were so furious about this. And then they suddenly started saying that, like, the Rainbow Pride LGBTQIA is dangerous and they don't want it for their kids, and they need to know what sex ed their kids are having, and lots of them blaming liberals and lefties and it was really, really interesting. The amount of them that also said they'd never voted as conservative, but this was making them more right wing. And I was like, whoa. Yeah. But as soon as, you know, your children, people you care about most in the world, are under threat, mums go crazy. Very useful.
Yes. I mean, I can definitely relate to that feeling. And I've also been on Mumsnet, and it's a very unique place. I mean, it's quite right wing in many ways. I mean, you know, those women are feral. I mean, some are crazy, but some are crazy in a good way because they're crazy and right wing. So I support the crazy moms of Mumsnet. And I know it's been quite powerful also in fighting trans stuff as well. I mean, a lot of organizing has been done through Mumsnet, or a lot of radicalizing has been done through Mumsnet. So yeah, it's a worthy place. I appreciate my fellow mothers fighting the good fight. What I also wanted to ask you about is the attitude towards the opposite sex, because, you know, we're in this confusing time, and you know, masculinity is either missing or maligned, or, you know, there's a strange attitude towards you know, how people should comport themselves towards the opposite sex, and especially if you're male. So I wonder what kind of in your cohort the attitude is towards masculinity. I mean, what are you looking for in a partner of the opposite sex? You know, how would one recognize a worthy man in 2023, 2024 now? Oh, I'm a bit behind.
For me personally, I have to have someone more intelligent than me, because I just love mansplaining.
Oh God.
No, I think I've had boyfriends in the past who we get on well, we've got loads in common, but they're not politically engaged, or they are, like, definitely not that bright, and it's just so frustrating. And as a woman, I want a man who can teach me and show me the way, kind of thing. Not to sound like a super trad, but I want to be led.
You're a trad wife posting right now. You're looking for headship, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm not a pick me girl. This is just trad. Yeah. I also just, I could not date someone on the left, because I think that's a sign of low intelligence. But yeah, someone who will lead a woman. I mean, I am a Christian, and I think that what the Bible says that you should look for in a man really is everything that you could ask for, like being gentle and kind and taking care of you, that being strong, and if you're a Christian, like being able to lead you in your faith as well.
I think there's a supply and demand issue here, to be honest, because a lot of, at least to me, it feels like a lot of this trad wife posting, I mean, the stuff that's not necessarily related to porn, because a lot of it is essentially, you know, people kind of creating a new genre of porn. It's this longing in young women for a certain compliment. You know, it's kind of like, I will show myself as this complimentary energy to you. And I want to conjure this masculinity out of, you know, guys. But I think a lot of women that I know, and I've been kind of been in this trad wife cycle for a while, you know, they just, you know, they get married and then they essentially have to, you know, they're trying to elicit this type of energy, but it's just not there. Like, you know, to be the trad wife to some guy who just, you know, plays video games all day and, you know, is waiting for his tendies on the couch. It's a bit of a misleading exercise. So it's, I think it can be tough in certain circumstances to be the trad wife or to, you know, to put these energies out there and they're not necessarily being reciprocated.
Yeah, I mean, I just think you've got to be realistic as well. Like, be a trad wife if you want, but also live in the real world. I don't know if you've seen these videos of this. There's a few women who do it where they say, my husband said he wanted cinnamon toast cereal. And she, like, bakes it from scratch. And she, like, your husband's probably starving, or he's probably, like, out getting a McDonald's sausage and egg McMuffin at this point. Because it's a LARP, and it's for the views. It's not for the husband at that point. It's literally just.
Yeah. I think that ladies actually had like an OnlyFans or something like that. You know, a lot of this stuff is just a funnel. I don't buy anything on the internet anymore. It's all just a funnel of eyes onto something. And a lot of this is just like rage bait, you know, but yeah.
Yeah. There's also the ones who will post videos of them frolicking with their children in a field of flowers. And I just always picture them going and setting up the phone and setting the timer. And they'd be like, kids, we're frolicking now, okay? Put away your iPad. We're going to frolic for the camera. And it just seems so fake. Like, there's things that I think are great. Like, I love cooking. I actually do enjoy cleaning because I'm a bit of a neat freak, but I would also, like, I would cook a meal from scratch and then want to sit and watch it in front of the TV and then go and sit on my phone. Like, you don't have to be a pure trad, you've just got to live in the real world, because yeah, if you've got your gamer husband waiting for his chicken tendies, you're just gonna be frustrated that he's not playing his part.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, you know, you really put the point on it, because it is kind of playing a part. And I feel like, you know, there are certain directions that are kind of sexes push us into, and I think it's good to explore those and lean into them. But if it's just about, you know, putting on a costume and, you know, playing the part, it really, it really does get frustrating if, you know, the other person's not playing it perfectly and is not doing, you know. So I think the more successful relationships that I know tend to realize that complementarity and, you know, look for it and understand that, you know, there's probably going to be some, some direction that's more aligned with gender roles that people go into. And, you know, they're, you know, you're probably better at, you know, fixing things around the house. I'm probably better at the cooking, or at least I enjoy it more. But it's not, you know, you haven't, what was that? I think Steven Crowder video about him yelling at his pregnant wife about, you know, not fulfilling her wifely duties. And she's trying to, you know, feed the dog some, you know, toxic medicine. And it's just, you know, this whole over-reliance on, okay, you know, this is your job and this is my job. And, you know, especially if you love someone and if you're under conditions of stress, like, especially if you have small children, it's a stressful environment. And if you're just like, oh, I'm not going to, you know, clean any diapers. And I understand that it's not pleasant, but if you love your wife, it's not even like a conversation, you know. It's like, no, diaper duty, it's you. And, you know, I'll see you in a couple of years when the kids are older, and then I'll start helping, because that's more of a manly thing to do. That's just insane and abusive. And yeah, it's just very much identifying with these roles that have to be flexible at one point, because, you know, life gets tough in different ways. And we, you know, the essence of marriage is to be able to collaborate on these fronts. But yeah, it doesn't work in the frolicking Instagram video format that well.
Yeah, I think one of the downsides of the internet is you can very easily fall into, or like, have created an algorithm which is going to show you the women making your cinnamon toast cereal from scratch, and the like, not like Andrew Tate, but Manosphere people who are like, changing diapers is gay and loving your wife is gay. So you just need to go to the gym with your bros and eat raw beef. Like, and if that's what you're constantly consuming, and then you're thinking, wow, yeah, this is how to live the perfect life. This is true masculinity, and leaving my wife at home to do everything like that is true femininity. But the people writing half of this stuff are probably single, lonely people who don't even practice what they're
on the subcontinent, most likely. Which is most the case. Most of the case is all like, not all, like, anonymous Manosphere posters. For some reason, 90% of them are Indian.
Well, I guess it's a great place to sun your balls.
It is indeed. One of the better places. And on that note, I think it's a weird one, because people are very susceptible to being influenced by this stuff, because there's not really other, you know, there's not really a big tradition to draw on. I mean, like, your family is more conservative, you know, you're plugged into religion and things like that. So you have more of a root system than most people. But most people just, you know, when they turn on the internet and they see these influencers, like, they're, you know, they're kind of these semi-godlike like creatures to a lot of people. So they take their cues from these spaces. And it's kind of, you know, it's worrying, because, you know, like we said, these are not necessarily people who are wise. They're just pretty good, I guess, at marketing themselves, or they're very prolific in putting out threads of, you know, 10 things to do if you're a real man. And, you know, it's not ideal. I think on the level of your own family, I think it's really important to try to maintain rituals, traditions, and have conversations with your children about these things, because there's a huge infrastructure now that can't wait to, you know, feed them all sorts of ideas alongside ads, obviously. Yeah. So that, yeah, they're well informed about the world.
Yeah, it's something that's always on my mind. It's how I will raise my kids. But I think, I used to be a nursery teacher, and I think that taught me so much about what I will and won't do. Like, won't let them watch Cocomelon. Won't stick an iPad in front of them at 6 months old. Because, yeah, as much as you can control what they're watching, like, I was a kid once, and I knew how to bypass any restrictions based on anything. So it's a scary world. But yeah, it's something I think you've got to, like, think about before you reach that point. And you can definitely get caught up too much, as well as in the masculinity and femininity online discourses, like crunchy parenting or all natural parenting, and go too far and get obsessed with it and it takes over your life. And there's definitely women who are faking that for the posts as well. But yeah, a good balance, like living in the real world, but also trying to do the best, but not trusting any old, like, so-and-so trad account on Twitter. It's just, yeah, they're not real. Like, you've got, hopefully, we'll have your mother and her mother to draw on from what worked, because you've survived and you've come out, you know, as a hopefully decent person. So, yeah, better to go for that than internet strangers.
I'm recovering crunchy mom myself. And I know so many mothers who kind of had children at the same time as I did. And we're all about the microplastics and seed oils and all this type of stuff. And then slowly, you know, you emerge, especially after having two children. And, you know, it's all, you know, obviously I'm not, you know, completely flipped, but I've dropped a lot of my, you know, the rigors of very specific ways of raising children. But at the same time, you know, like you mentioned Cocomelon, like now I think the last Cocomelon has like trans kids in it, and, you know, gay parents dancing. And I'm like, okay, this is definitely not something I'd do. But yeah, it's very nuanced. You know, once you live through things, in my case, I wasn't really plugged into like a long line of mothers and grandmothers. I don't really have any close family. So I kind of had to, you know, make my own ideas up from scratch with related to how I raised my kids. But yeah, I mean, you just have to do it. And also one thing I've noticed with children is that they kind of prompt you to act certain ways because they're very different. Like both my sons are very different. They had different needs from the start. So they kind of teach you what they need. Like with some children, you can have a, you know, very serious parenting philosophy that they get this and then they eat this and they sleep at these hours, and they just don't. They'll just do, you know, they'll prompt you to feed them X and put them to sleep at Y hour, and that's it. no questions asked. So yeah. I mean, are there any more, you know, except for, you know, no screen time or very low screen time, is there any other idea that you've had while, you know, being a nursery teacher is something that's really important to you for your own family?
It's hard to say to someone that has two children, because what if you do these things?
Oh, I can do it. No worries. I've got a thick hide. It's fine.
Dummies. I really don't like dummies. I've just seen too many kids' teeth with like huge gaps in the middle because of dummies. Sugary drinks at like under two. So the nursery that I worked in, it was during COVID, and it was in a pretty deprived area because there was like, I applied for that job, and there were 50 other applicants. I just had to take what I could get because I knew I wanted to work with children. It was COVID and I wanted to be able to like live normal life, be able to go out to work and not have to wear a mask in the workplace kind of thing. And I couldn't social distance from the toddlers, so it was great. But yeah, being in a quite a deprived area, there were a lot of things I saw that really shocked me. Like children under two coming in with a bottle with like diluted squash in, just like sugar going straight onto their teeth, or milky sugary tea, because apparently this is a thing that comes from when people lived in poverty, and the only way of getting, like, they had to use so little milk that putting it in tea made them feel like they were giving their child more milk or something. And I had to say to this woman, like, you know that has caffeine in, and your child isn't even two. like that's not great. And she was kind of telling me, don't tell me how to parent. I've got four kids and you're, what was I, like 20 years old? And I was like, but you're like killing them. So I kind of do want to tell you what to do. Yeah. And then also screen time, like some children would get picked up, put in a pushchair at 4 years old and just have an iPad put in front of them. And I would just know they would go home that night and sit in front of it until they went to bed. I'm very much for some TV because you cannot entertain a toddler 24/7 and they're so demanding. And a bit of TV is great. Like I watched so much TV as a kid and it didn't harm me.
Me too. I mean, the fact that I speak English now is just because I watch so much. Yeah. But we know what we do. Especially cause now I have two kids and then if I need to deal with baby and like toddlers watching some TV. So, we just have like Disney movies on repeat and he just knows them by heart and just like, you know, he kind of tunes them out. He plays, but it's kind of like a little anchoring point. So I know he's going to be at least in the vicinity of the TV while Frozen 2 is playing. And then he's going to sing the songs and then he's going to go back to whatever he's doing. So yeah, it's my, you know, my diluted version of screen time, but yeah, it works. So yeah. But you know, this is kind of interesting to me because, you know, we were talking about traditions and hopefully your mother's going to tell you what to do. But a lot of times, you know, there's also, you know, there are things like, you know, the diluted tea method and things like that, especially here, like here in the countryside, you know, if you're having problems with your baby sleeping, they sometimes give the baby some alcohol or things like that, you know, things that we now know probably not good, but traditional. So, yeah, I think it's good to have, again, a balanced approach to all of these things because, yeah, it's... Yeah, it also depends, you know, what background you're from. You know, I can imagine these traditions differ from region to region.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know about giving alcohol. Like, it's obviously, it's, you know, the Lindy thing. It's kind of...
It's Lindy, yeah.
It's continued because it has worked. But the thought of giving alcohol to a baby just... There's something in me. Like, I couldn't do it.
Especially the local moonshine, which has like, it tastes like pure gasoline. I have no idea how the baby would, you know, you have to really mix it into something because, yeah, and people starting solids really early here, like they would give babies, like maybe 3 months old, like little bits of cooked food that they had. I mean, it doesn't kill the baby. It's probably not good for it, you know, like their liver is not developed enough, you know, things like that. And so, yeah, there's worse things than baby formula, believe me.
Yeah.
They are traditional. So yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting because I speak to some people here, like we have a nanny for my toddler who comes in the morning so that we both can work because we both work from home. And she's kind of from the countryside here and she just tells me, you know, she comes from a completely different era. So like crunchy, but in a way like, you know, 1400s type crunchy, you know, so very, very interesting approaches. And she was telling me like, well, you know, because people in her village, I mean, they still had like an average of 6, 7, 8 children, you know, in her parents' generation. So the people in her cohort, and she's kind of in her 50s now. So, and she skipped from 8 children to 2 children. So things really went downhill really fast. So she was a generation that moved to the city. And, you know, things changed from, you know, 1400 standards to, I guess, 2000 standards. She was telling me that, you know, when she was a child, like babysitting wasn't really, you know, wasn't really done. It was, you know, they would put you in your little individual crib. And then there was like an older child who would kind of check in on you. But that was where you were, especially during like agricultural calendar times when people had to harvest or so or things like that, you know, that's it all day in there. You get some water, you get some snacks, goodbye. No daycare, no nothing. And that sounds absolutely insane to me. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't leave my child in like in his crib for more than like, you know, 5-10 minutes. But yeah, that's just the way things had to be. And it was quite rough. And, you know, she was telling me about, you know, the fact that her mom had 8 children, but only 6 survived. And, you know, the stories of the children dying were also horrible, like, you know, traumatizing stuff, but they just had to keep on keeping on. It's like, you know, it's a completely different reality to kind of the luxury of caring for children that we have now. It is in a way a luxury, because back then it really was just, you know, extra hands in the family. And yeah, just a much more easygoing attitude towards children, which, yeah, I don't know if it necessarily benefited them, but there definitely were more of them. So I personally am kind of conflicted about a lot of this stuff. But yeah, I mean, in my family, we have a, you know, much more careful attitude towards children, inevitably, because I, you know, you just love them so much. And yeah, that's just how it's going to be.
Yeah. So my grandfather was one of 13. They basically had 13 to work on the farm, because they were, I don't know what it's called, one of those home farms that were, they were moved down the country during World War II so that they could farm to provide for the nation. But he started work at 4 years old, and his dad was constantly in trouble with the school because he just wouldn't send them to school because they were his workers. And he just spent his childhood looking after pigs, harvesting crops, a really tough life. And he was a brilliant painter, or still is a brilliant painter. And his dad ripped up his offer to go to art school in front of him. It's like, no, you work for me, and then you'll do your national service, and then you'll go down the mines or whatever. And his grandfather used to, if they spoke whilst he was trying to listen to the radio, he would hit them with a belt. And he always says to me how strange it is that that was his experience of his grandfather. And he, as my grandfather, would, you know, teach us to paint and change our nappies and make us bubble baths, and constantly he's like obsessed with looking after us. Even at my age, if I go to his house, he'll be like tucking a blanket around me and bringing me snacks. And just what a difference in 2 generations of how you see children as a joy now rather than as an inconvenience or a worker to provide for the family. But I don't know, maybe because they had so many more children then, they weren't as special, whereas I'm one of 3 and I'm the only girl, so I'm like, you know, I feel super special in my family. And yeah, we just got so much more attention and quality time and affection. I mean, my mum's one of 6, and they had nannies and au pairs, although she was a teenager when her youngest sibling was born, and she used to love to pitch in. But we were all had so close together that like no one was raising the younger ones. Although I definitely tried with my brother, who's only 18 months younger than me. I used to pick him up and carry him around. I've always known I love children. I want my own children.
Yeah, that's been a really interesting revelation to me as well, because I have 2 sons, and one's 2 years older than the other. And you know, I take my son to like little play groups and stuff. He's not ready for kindergarten yet, but you know, there are little girls there as well, and the little girls are just so, you know, they're trying to, you know, because he's really cute. He's got like little blonde ringlets, and they kind of adopt him as their baby, especially if they're slightly older. I mean, my son would not do that with his brother. He just tries to, you know, not kill him, but maybe by accident. He tries to, you know, take him, jump with him, you know, smash him up a little bit. Just, you know, the usual boys being boys type stuff. But yeah, it's such a crazy difference in terms of, yeah, sexual dimorphism or whatever it's called. Yeah, it's it's visible, especially, I mean, I'd love to have a little girl as well, and then we could, you know, do some sociological experiments there. But yeah, it's a crazy difference.
Yeah, I was almost sort of convinced that basically until puberty, boys and girls were the same, until I worked in a nursery and basically just give a pushchair and a baby doll to a boy and to a girl. Obviously, that's going to be one-offs where they're different, but the boys will throw the doll and race around with the pushchair like it's a car. And the girls will nurse it and push it around nicely and feed it. And that's at like 2 years old or younger, like 18 months. They're just so different. And that really blew my mind that, like, no, it's definitely not societal constructs. Like, it's pretty natural. And it, like, obviously, we have different hormones and you will behave differently if you have testosterone and estrogen. And women are naturally more maternal. So, and that's like a hormonal thing. You can't change that.
So, yeah.
And it clearly does start in early years. All I ever played with was baby dolls in the toy kitchen. A trad from an earlier issue. But yeah, every Christmas I just wanted the new accessories for the doll and the new bed and pushchair. And I just used to spend all of my weekends just like playing with it and feeding it and putting it to bed. Quite funny.
Yeah, my son had a phase with baby dolls just before the baby was born, because I kept explaining, okay, baby's coming, there's going to be a baby and stuff like that. And he would go to like his little play group and go straight to the dolls and like line them up. And then he would do like little experiments on them to, you know, check their eyes and open their mouths and see and get this, you know, the clothes off of them just to check exactly what the components are of this baby that's going to come. So that he understands the mechanics of the baby before the baby's here. Because, you know, and even after the baby was born, because I couldn't let him, you know, kiss and strangle the baby. So I just kind of let them approach each other gently without any violence. So he would just go to the playgroup and then just like, you know, get his curiosity out on the play babies instead of our own. But yeah, it is interesting. And the way he really is really into how things work, like, you know, sometimes in the afternoons he has this like very autistic, you know, habit of opening drawers and looking at, you know, like the mechanism of the drawer on the sides and what slides into what. And he's just like opening, closing for like half an hour. And I'm like, okay, if that's what you want to do, please do it. Seems like quite a peaceful thing to do. But, you know, it's just it's really, yeah, it's funny.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I love about working with kids is when you don't have the time, or when you're just so used to things being the way they are because of the way they are, you see how children interact with the world and they will like stop and look at how a drawer works and you think, I don't even know how a drawer works. Or they'll point at like a pine cone on the floor and you're just like, oh yeah. There is a pine cone, it must be that time of year. And they ask how things work, or a child asked me, like, where does your food go once from your tummy? And yeah, just like even thinking it through and explaining, you learn so much of being with children from teaching them and actually thinking things through in way more detail. But also, yeah, it's so nice to see them have that curiosity at such an early age and think, huh, if you're interested in that now, you know, you could become an engineer or an architect or,
yeah.
And then to think in the future, you'll look back and think, oh, now he's built, I don't know, a submarine. And I remember when he used to watch the drawers over and close.
Yeah, exactly. It is really interesting though what particular things they're interested in, because we took our toddler to the aquarium now when we were in New Zealand, and it's all just like these majestic, you know, stingrays and crayfish, and it looks all very cool. And as a woman, that's kind of what interests me, all the little biological things and like, wow, look. And then he was interested in the filtration system. He was really, this is, wow, he has spent like 15 minutes looking at the filtration system. And the accessibility ramp was big favorite. He just ran up and down the accessibility ramp. He really likes the turns and all this stuff. So we spent about half an hour at the accessibility ramp. You know, we just raced through the crayfish and the stingrays and all this cool stuff and through the tunnel, you know, where you go and see, oh, look at the sharks. Not interested at all, but, you know, there are quite, you know, little details, little technical details that are much more important. But yeah, I think it's also the age. He's just like, he's just about, you know, two and a half. And, you know, he's still just not, some things just don't come through to him yet. He's just, yeah, very much focused on the stuff that he can see at his level, especially because that's also important that he can only see at his eye level. Yeah, there's one of your articles I wanted to talk about as well. Which and there's kind of this little quote from it, which is a statistic that I was not aware of and I think is quite interesting. I didn't expect this. White pupils are the least likely amongst various ethnic groups in the UK to pursue higher education, with only 33.3% continuing on to higher education, whilst in comparison, 72.1% of Chinese students go to university. This is quite a shocking little bit of information, because, you know, we are told that, you know, the white majority, you know, this is, you know, this is the land of, I mean, things have changed already to a point that it doesn't really feel like, it doesn't really feel like there's a dominant majority anymore, is there?
It doesn't feel like there's a what?
A dominant majority, or, you know, there's a kind of a group that's dictating the mores of the country.
Yeah, although we are whites, Brits are still the majority. They are definitely not the most privileged anymore in terms of what you have access to because of positive discrimination. Like, yeah, there's so many things and schemes and courses that you can only do if you have a skin color that's not white. And that's just so crazy. What, I don't know any, apart from like America, probably Australia, but like any Eastern countries, I don't know any of them that have this same thing where they're like, we're just going to give our own citizens, our own native citizens, the worst chance just because. Like, and I don't even know why it is. Is it guilt or is it performative? But why would you do that? Why would you want to harm the chances of the majority of your country? Or, yeah, it's like they expect that everyone's just got an easy ride for being white. But, you know, that might be the people that are making these decisions, that might be the case for their social circles, the people that they grew up with. But the people that are making these decisions to discriminate against white people did not grow up in, you know, northern towns where the industry's gone and there's no opportunity. And often the only thing to do is to go on benefits because there are just no jobs. Because these places only exist because there was a mill or there was mines, and now there's just nothing to replace it. And they are the people that should be looked after by the systems that are discriminating against them. You know, most ethnic minorities live in urban areas where there are so many more opportunities, and yeah, better schools, more further education and higher education. So why should they be given the foot up and not people who have thousands of years of ancestry in this country and are now just being neglected? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it partially, at least, with the fact that, you know, a lot of the people making these decisions are not the ones paying the cost for them. Or are people who can say, okay, you know, even with this additional burden, I'm so intelligent or so well connected or so, you know, that, you know, my children will be fine. You know, this is not my class's problem. And you can see this in the US as well. Like a lot of this, you know, the woke culture war is kind of a fight between upper and lower class whites, or at least upper and middle class whites, where, you know, the middle classes in the US, you know, have kind of like these nouveau riche. They don't know all the cool, you know, new mores and new things to say, or, you know, they're not maybe Ivy League educated, or they just, you know, went to community college and they know how to make money. But for the upper classes to distance themselves from the middle classes, they have to have, you know, these luxury beliefs, you know, all the wokeness. And, you know, that's kind of the big tension there. And I think it's probably something similar in the UK, where class works a little bit differently, but still, it's, yeah, there's definitely an intelligentsia. I think Matt Goodwin writes about this class quite well, that, you know, you need to, you know, money is not a sufficient distinguishing factor anymore. And I guess nobility isn't either anymore, even in the UK. So you need something else. And that something else is, you know, throwing your fellow poor whites down the drain, I guess, is that's, you know, the national pastime.
Yeah, it's definitely a privileged thing to... And even whether that's a class thing, it's a privilege thing to be able to sacrifice your time to go on Palestine marches or BLM marches. Or I've been seeing teenagers calling for like a strike of all activities for Palestine, which includes not even doing mobile banking or ordering takeaways. I don't know how they're going to cope. But yeah, they don't have kids to provide for. They probably don't have rent to pay. They're probably living with their parents, or the people on Palestine marches are possibly living in social housing or on benefits, but they're not at work. They're standing shouting at McDonald's on a Monday morning. They're not at work.
Yeah, it's an alliance between people who don't have to pay rent because their parents pay their rent, and people who don't have to pay rent because the state pays their rent. Everyone else is at work.
Yeah. We don't have the privilege to go and protest about things which we're not even going to change. You're right. The two groups that are best off in this country are the ones that are just live completely supported by the taxpayer and have everything handed to them on a plate. And gosh, yeah, so many things about that. You know, they can get citizenship so easily. And now they've just changed it so that you can work whilst waiting for asylum. You can get put up in a 5-star hotel. Those people have all the time in the world, no money problems. Because they will never be let to slip through the net, because then, you know, the country has let down the most vulnerable people. And then the people who have generational wealth and an art student, and they've got all the time to go and protest for causes that are trendy, that they don't even have emotional attachment to.
Yeah, and a lot of these causes also betray, you know, an unfamiliarity with reality. You know, people who haven't really been thrust into what it means to, you know, fend for yourself, or it's kind of like parenthood. You really can't model it. You have to go through it, and then you see exactly, you know, what it is. You can be really crunchy before you have children, or when you have one child instead of two or three, you know, you can do all of this stuff. And I think, you know, you can be very much about, you know, Palestine until you actually go to, you know, maybe volunteer in the third world, and then be a bit more, you're a bit more weathered and wise. But yeah, you know, it's armchair, you know, cause, allegiance to causes that really don't, you know, they're hard to imagine for, you know, people who are not actually directly involved. Yeah. So I think this is probably a good place to slowly wrap it up. I think we're coming up on time. I have a bit of a moment here. The last question, the question of the show, this is one everyone gets. It's, do you have a subversive thinker? It could be any sort of type of writer, or even, you know, currently living journalist, any sort of recommendation for the listeners, someone that they should check out, maybe someone who's been influential in your thinking.
So can I do a Substack? Which
sure.
Yeah. So there's a couple of guys that run a Substack, but they get lots of other people to write for them, and it's basically, I think, exclusively anons, and most of it's satire, some of it's like laugh out loud funny, but there are some incredible like in-depth analysis articles or like great ideas that have really, if you look back and realize when they were written, you realize that they have really shaped not only discussion on Twitter or X, but that discussion online, which has then led to policy change, or at least, you know, government figures talking about issues. Like, they really pushed things like the social housing debate. And there was a brilliant one the other day by Fedmo. I don't know how I'm saying that right. I don't know if you know that account.
Yeah, I know that account.
Yeah. About how easy it is to get citizenship in the UK, and that something like 4% of citizenship applications are denied, which is so crazy. And then it looks into what the rest of the world require for citizenship. Like, Nigeria is incredibly difficult to get into. You have to have like a character recommendation from a religious figure. And live there for something like 12 years. And you're like, why are we so stupid in this country? So yeah, they do some great, great articles, and a lot of them are free as well. But the paid ones are great too. So I would definitely recommend everyone at least has a look at it.
What's it called?
It's called J'accuse.
Oh yes, that's the one I thought you meant. Yeah, it's really good. I recommend it as well. I've only read a few pieces on there, but yeah, they do tend to make their way through the direct message groups in the background. Yeah, they're really spicy, and whoever is in charge of that, chapeau, very very good work. Perfect. I will put that in the show notes. And I want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks.
I'm very glad. I'm very glad you came on. Is there any place that you'd like people to check out? I know you have pieces at The Critic. I know you're on Twitter at Fleur Meston. Any other place people can find you?
Not just yet, but in the works. I'm starting my own podcast with a friend, although it's not completely set up yet, but keep an eye out. I will post it on my Twitter.
I'll forward it to everyone when it's out.
Thank you.
We're excited. Cheers. Thank you so much.
Thank you.